The Bain Free Radio Hour.
Hello and welcome to the Bain Free Radio Hour. This week, Griffin Barber sits down with Casey Azell to discuss her sequel to the brilliant Magelight, Blood on the Sand. After that, we'll have more One Jump Ahead by Mark L. Van Name, Part 58. Hello and welcome to the Bain Free Radio Hour. I'm your host, Griffin Barber, and I'm here today with one of my favorite authors and actual co-author sometimes, Casey Azell, to talk about Blood on the Sand, the sequel to the wonderfully engaging Magelight, also quite original. So, Casey, tell us a little bit about yourself and a little bit about Magelight, maybe, and then we'll get on to the meat of the story.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you, Griff. You're also one of my favorite people. I appreciate that. So I am Casey Azell. I write emotionally charged adventure, fantasy, and science fiction. I wrote Magelight. I wrote it about a year. Well, it came out a year ago, I wrote it, you know, before that, obviously, because that's how these things generally work.
time math.
That's right. Time math years ago. I wrote Magelight for a couple of reasons, right? I wanted to write fantasy. The majority of my background, including what you and I have written together, has been some form or shade of military science fiction or military influenced alternate history, which is great. And I love those genres, but I can't pick a lane. So I often describe myself as genre fluid because I read across all these genres and I love consuming stories in all this, you know, different sorts of milieus. And so I wanted to do fantasy because I've been a fantasy reader since I was really young. And there, you know, magic and kind of like that sword and sorcery sort of vibe of going on adventures and figuring things out and all of that kind of stuff. Like that just draws me in. I'm a gamer and I play a monthly in-person tabletop role-playing D&D game, right? So it's like fantasy adventure gaming. And it's something that I've loved for like a really long time. So when I decided to start writing fantasy, I kind of pulled a lot of those elements in along with I also read romance and I love romance. And I sometimes describe it as my guilty pleasure, but the truth is I don't really feel that guilty about it. But I really enjoy reading reverse harem romance, which is typically where you'll have one female main character and she'll have multiple love interests and she doesn't have to choose between them, right? Because the dynamics of interpersonal relationships are always like super fascinating to me. And that's one that's like, whoa, how does this work? How would this work? Because I am certain that there are people out there in real life land who make that work, but I can't imagine how it would work in real life, but it works really well in fiction. And it's fun to read about, right? It's a fun way to explore kind of the nuances of how people relate with one another.
For sure.
Yeah. So, so when I decided to write fantasy, I kind of rolled all that up into a burrito and out came Magelight. Magelight is the story of a young sorceress who all her life has been told that she's just not good enough. And she really kind of internalizes that and has very poor self-esteem, but she clings to her dreams until the point when she can't. And that is when she is publicly, humiliatingly betrayed by her best friend and the man she thought she loved. And she's basically broken, left with nothing. And so she's like, well, I guess I'll run. I guess I'll run away. Right. And she does. And she runs away on a horse by herself at night through bandit infested woods, wearing like noblewoman's clothing. So you can imagine how well that works out for her. And she ends up.
Is it walking loot crate?
Yeah, exactly. Basically. Well, a horse-born loot crate anyway, a riding loot crate. Somebody's like, I'm going to get that NPC. But unfortunately for them, she's not an NPC. And she manages to make it to this inn where these three very competent men have just reunited after They grew up together. They were separated through, severe tragedy. They had their own, struggles and trials and things that shaped them and formed them and trained them. And now they've come back together to form a business, go into business for themselves, right? Every time I talk about this part of the story, I get that speech from Ghostbusters with Bill Murray, saying, call it fate, call that always runs through my mind when I think about this scene. But that's basically what happened. And one of them rescues her, and she ends up hiring them to take her home, escort her home, because clearly she needs the help. And that's just when things start getting weird, because the bandits, after being chased off by, excess firepower, although it's not really firepower because it's not, it's a sword and not guns. But they return, which is real weird, right? Like totally uncharacteristic. But they return and they attack again, and they make it very clear that what they're after is not necessarily the girl's wealth, but the girl herself. And they lock them in the building and set it on fire. And so Aelys and these three adventuring men are trapped. And they're not going to make it out. Like, they're going to die. They know it. And then Aelys does something in this extreme situation. She does something that she doesn't know she can do, and manages to somehow pull off some big magic, bigger than she's ever done before. And in the
Trauma
process,
magic.
she, what's that? Trauma magic. Yes.
The magic
It's
of trauma.
a good term. Yeah, that's right. That's right. In the process, she does save their lives, but she also accidentally binds all three of these very dangerous, very competent, very sexy men to her in an emotional bond that they didn't necessarily consent to nor ask for. Or understand, when they said that, yeah, we're here, we're going to stay with you. So that's kind of like
The
the
starter.
setup. Yeah, right. It's a very like tangled situation, because they have to navigate all of these like emotional, nuances, and what is real and what is magic, and where does consent fit into this? And by the end of it, they've sort of kind of got things worked out, but
Between themselves and her, but not between each other, right?
well, they have it. It's almost the opposite, right? The guys have it worked out between each other, because there's other things going on with them too. They made an oath to be sworn brothers, and in doing so, whether knowingly or unknowingly, invoked the notice of three of their deities. And so this sworn brotherhood is sort of like, kind of like has the divine stamp of approval on it, like right there on their hands. So there is a mystical bond between the three men as well, but it's a bond of brotherhood. And I think that, well, I don't think, I know for sure, although I don't actually say it on the page, but it's pretty clear that that has a lot to do with
The
why these
success
three
of
guys, yeah, why they can manage to wrap their heads around this tangled relationship Gordian knot that they all have. And all of this is taking place while they are fleeing from bandits and fighting these goblin ant creatures called goblants, and falling into caves and finding ancient magic caches, and just trying to take this chick home, I've had people ask me if it's a romantasy, and my answer is always that it isn't, because in according to my definition that I'm like trying to make standard, a romanticy is really a romance novel, and the central question of a romance novel is, are these people going to get together or aren't they? And that's not really the central question here. The central question is more about, can Aelys grow up and own her choices and the consequences that come with them, or is she going to give up and remain sheltered and let people dictate to her what her life is going to look like, right? That's really the central question of the story.
Which is kind of a, it's more of an epic fantasy. The child coming out of the farming town, etc. But
That's right. Yeah, Ben Yallo characterized it as a coming of age story, and it really is for her. But it's also an adventure, and it's got a strong romantic subplot, which I love and I'm not ashamed of.
why would you be?
No, of course not, right? It's so funny because I hear people sometimes are like, oh, but romance, and I want to be like, guys, come on, romance has always been a part of fantasy storytelling. You know, Lois McMaster Bujold, in her, well, I don't know if you'd call this fantasy, but the entire Vorkosigan saga is based on the love story between, you know, Cordelia and Vorkosigan, right? So, like, yeah, that's
Well, I
it's
mean,
nothing new.
it's also it's part of human endeavor, right? It always is going to be, especially if you're young and young and attractive, you're going to have these situations arise,
That's
whether you
right.
want them or not.
Right, that's right. Yeah. So that's sort of like the quick and dirty of Mage Light. Blood on the Sand picks up pretty much right where Mage Light leaves off, and you know, there have been new complications having to do with, you know, the choices Aelys makes in book one, and so the relationship between her and the guys is in some ways a lot simpler and a lot cleaner, and in other ways way more complicated. And so they're still sort of figuring this out, while continuing to try and figure out why she is being targeted by these unsavory characters, and what do we do about that right now? You know, so they end up taking a journey. There's a ship, there's a shipwreck, there's a dragon,
There's always a ship.
and
When there's a ship, it seems like there's always a shipwreck.
I mean, in a fantasy story, it's usually a pretty good. There's either a shipwreck or pirates, right? One of
Or both.
the two, so or both, and they end up going to a city called Xandrine, which is the city that our warrior character Romic actually grew up in after he was separated from his sworn brothers as children. So he the backstory there is that the three boys grew up in the same village in the mountains, and when they were about 12 years old, they were like best friends, and they would leave, you know, run out and play in the woods all day long. Well, one day when they were out playing, their village got attacked and burnt to the ground, and they came home, you know, when the sun was down, and they found just a smoking ruin and the bodies of everyone they had ever known. And so they, you know, quickly grabbed what they could to eat and went back to their hiding place in the woods, like scared, you know, shitless as young children. And what do we do, right? And they're under all this stress and everything. And so the next morning, when they're trying to decide what do we do, where do we go, they get into an argument and they get separated. They separate and they never see each other again for like 20 years. They, you know, different things happen to the three of them. For Romic, he gets picked up by some more unsavory characters and he fights back because he's a big kid, he's kind of a brawler. And they're like, oh, okay, we've got a use for you. And they end up selling him to a slave caravan that transports him down to Xandrine, which is one of the big cities in this empire, in the southern part of the empire, that is mad about gladiatorial games. And so he ends up being an arena slave for a period of time.
Now he's back.
And now he's back. Yeah, he was so good as an arena slave that he earned his freedom, and left the city and was like, I'll never go back there, right?
You have an equivalent of the wood gladius?
Of the what?
The wooden gladius?
I have a wooden gladius. I specifically mentioned that. Yeah, because I think that's a cool thing, right?
Oh yeah, totally.
Yeah, and I draw a lot from and several reviewers have mentioned this. I draw a lot from ancient Rome, but I also draw a lot from like medieval Europe, and just legends, right? Because what I'm looking for is that sort of like fantasy feeling of this is another world, but it's familiar. It calls to those tropes that I know from my childhood, right? You know, so we've got a little bit of like Conan going on there. We've got a little bit of you know, Russell Crowe and Gladiator going on there. We've got a little bit of a lot actually from the HBO Spartacus miniseries that I watched when I was deployed. You know, things like that. So
I'm rewatching it right now.
it's so good. Oh my God, it's so good. Such a good series.
I love about it the most is the dialogue.
The swearing.
Just the dialogue
Yeah,
in
it's
the way
really
that
good.
they make it sound foreign without making it everybody British. They manage to, this is not English. This is another language that they're speaking. And some people sound like barbarians when they're speaking it, and
That's
that's
right.
fine. Yeah. No, and
Yeah.
the lack of there is no Christian morality behind what they're doing. They're doing actively doing stuff behind a different morality, which is the Roman ethos, which is alien to most of us.
Right. Very, very much might makes right based, right? So,
Or
yeah.
glory makes right. Because
Glory.
not even necessarily might, because if you're weaker, you
Yeah.
win glory, right?
Sure. Yeah, no, that's true. That's true. That's true. Yeah, courage and
Glory.
strength of will. Yeah.
Straight up glory. If you can,
Yeah.
you pull it out, then out of a circumstance where you were supposed to lose, they'll love you all
Right.
the more for it because of the glory that's accruing to your name. Yeah.
Right. Which honestly is one of the things that I do play with in Blood on the Sand, because I made it one of the things. So here's another influence. Like most nerds, I watched and loved the show Firefly. And there's an episode where I think the episode's called Jane Town, where they go back to this place where Jane Cobb, one of the characters,
The hero.
used to live. Yeah, the hero of Canton. That's right. And there's a statue of him there. I pulled from that in Blood on the Sand. And so when Romick is returning to the house that in a very real way his was built on his blood and sweat, because he made the people that had enslaved him, that owned him, he made them a fortune with his winnings, right? And so there's a statue of him in the courtyard of their villa, and as they walk up, he like everybody he's with is looking at this thing going, holy shit. And he's like, yeah, I don't want to talk about that.
Right.
So, yeah.
Cool. Very cool.
It was really fun to take these characters that I'd gotten to know through the first book, and put them together in a new
Environment.
setting, in a new environment, and kind of see how their relationship, not just their like romantic relationship, but their working relationship had matured. Especially with Aelys, because one of the things that I really, really hate in fiction is when a character develops in book one, and then in book two, she's right back where she was at the beginning of book one. That's not to say that progression is always linear. Oftentimes, as in real life, it can be like two steps forward, one
Give us
step back.
reasons why they took the steps back. Yeah.
Yes. Give us reasons. Give us a, some sort of emotional trigger. And in this case, Aelys really does have an opportunity to kind of like step up and be sort of, the confident, powerful sorceress that she's like learning to be, that she's always really wanted to be. Because it's a new environment. There's very few people who know her here, and the only person who knew her from, or there's two people who knew her from before, when she was weak, quote unquote, and they are part of the party, and they've now seen that she has gained all this strength and can do all of these cool things. So, yeah, it was a lot of fun. It was a lot of fun to write.
So you talked a little bit about world building and the characters and stuff. Kind of which came first for you? Did you kind of want to do the harem thing most? Did you want to do the for lack of a better term, the group fantasy that where they're
Yeah, I wanted to
adventuring
do an
fantasy?
adventure party
Yeah.
first. An adventure party first. And then I was like, but wouldn't it be fun if?
Yes,
So
and. Yes,
that's
yeah.
right. That's right. So that's why I have, Aelys is a sorceress, and then her three protectors are a warrior, Romick, I call him a forester, but he's a ranger archetype, right? So he's a woodsman, he's a master archer, he's a tracker. That's Dane. And then the third, her third protector is Vil, who is a master burglar who doesn't mind getting his hands dirty and doing some wet work on occasion. He's kind of sociopathic a little bit, because his morality, with Vil, I very much wanted to do something similar to what you were talking about with the morality in Spartacus. His morality is centered entirely around, I care about these things and I care about these people, and I don't care about anything else.
Everything else can burn to the ground. Gotcha.
Correct. Correct. Yeah.
It's kind of necessary for that line of work.
It is. But we also see some things that, like, in Blood on the Sand, we start to see a little bit of development from him too, right? Because there is a time, there is one sort of sub plot line that I ran with him where he's, got a heist in the city of Xandrine that he's got to accomplish in order to. It's basically the price of entry to the city from the professional thieves of the city, sort of a professional courtesy between criminals thing. And so on this heist, he sees evidence of of domestic violence, of domestic abuse, and he says that sort of thing offends me. So it's not that he's amoral, it's just he's very picky and choosy about what he decides
This has to be
to.
offended about.
Correct. Yeah. Correct.
No. That sounds very interesting. Have you answered the question for yourself? You don't have to necessarily tell us, but what's in the water that makes these three heroes come from that same town?
Honestly, it they what made them heroes is what they survived prior to Mage Light. It's just the bad luck that they had their village razed to the ground, the good luck that they weren't there at the time, but then the bad luck that they had to be separated afterwards, and the trials and tribulations that they went through after that.
I was thinking about Stand By Me when you
Oh,
talk about that.
yeah.
The 12-year-old that's going off on their own journey, but in this case, they went their separate ways, and that's why you don't go your separate ways. It's because
That's
you're,
right. Never split the party.
yeah.
That's.
So the cover is kind of interesting on this one too. You've got your warrior with his blazing gladius. And is that something out of the book itself, or
So not literally, no.
no?
But I worked with Sam Kennedy for these covers, who is a genius. I love the man. He's very, very, very good at what he does. And he with oh, I don't have it in reach. With Mage Light, Aelys was at the center of the diamond motif in the middle. And the colors around it were mostly like just
Bluish.
like with yeah, they were blue. But they had the streaks of because I use colors to symbolize each of these characters. With magic in this world, it doesn't have a color except as it's just energy, right? But Aelys, when she is visualizing it,
Proceed.
visualizes it in different colors. Yeah. And so to her, magic looks blue in her mind. And the energy that she gets from Romix specifically is red and hot and fiery. And it's not that's not an accident or a coincidence, because the divine, the goddess that he honors and follows is called the Red Lady. She's the goddess of war and fortune and sort of like a Mars type archetype, but they're all female because I don't know, I'm sexist, I whatever. So that's part of the reason why we have this very fiery imagery on the front, and also on the back, which was a surprise to me. On the back jacket, the cover designer put the flames on there when I was like, "Oh my God, that's so cool!" But yeah, so because this story really focuses a lot on Romic's backstory and on healing a lot of the trauma that he had, the wounds that he had from growing up, not being in control of his own destiny, being an enslaved person, having to fight for his life day in and day out. Basically, his choice was get good or die. So he chose to get very good. And that's true of all three of the men, but it came out in very different ways, I also really wanted a reason for all three of them to be so good at what they do. I didn't want them to just be like, oh yeah, you're a hero, so ergo you're a badass. Like I had to give them some significant obstacles to overcome so
To
that
have
they could
already
be
overcome, yeah, to have already overcome them.
correct. Yeah, correct. To make them into these like hardened, adventuring types that wouldn't flinch at doing some of the things that they have to do. So,
Very cool. So we're going to get a story from the Rangers' perspective then, or not necessarily from their perspective, but more centering on them as well. Is that the
Yeah,
plan for each of them?
I'm working on that one right now. I have not yet publicly announced the title, but I'll tell you
Uh-oh.
now if you want.
Yeah.
The title of book three is Wild as the Woods, and it is Dane's it takes us to Dane's domain, let's say. So we're gonna look at addressing some of the things that he had to deal with in his backstory, and healing some of his wounds, and helping him grow a little bit too, just like we did with Romic in Blood on the Sand. So
Very cool. Very cool.
yeah, I'm very excited. I'm just over, what am I at? I'm just over 25K into the story, so moving right along.
Nice. Very cool. Well, that's exciting. We always
Yeah.
like to hear that things are progressing, as they say.
Right.
Things that people knock on traditional public saying, "Oh, it's going to be this long." Well, if we pump, you give you 1 a year, I think you're doing pretty good.
Yeah, not if I can help it, it won't. Not
Yeah, exactly.
if I can help it. I mean, I won't make promises because it's not all within my control, but I'll do my best.
No, it's
Yeah.
I'm looking forward to finally getting the time to read them, because I've been
Yeah.
sitting with all my other stuff, but I will eventually, as they say, get to it.
Yeah.
My daughter read Mage Light and really enjoyed it, so
Oh, good. Oh, I'm so glad.
that's usually a good sign for me that I'm like, oh,
Yeah.
cool.
Yeah.
But as you know, I've got a few things on my plate too.
No, Griffin, really?
No. So then the one thing I just kind of wanted to ask was, would you say that you enjoyed the character development more than the world building, or the world building more than the character development, or did they kind of inform each other?
Well, they definitely inform each other for sure, right? Because I mentioned the goddesses earlier. That kind of came completely by serendipity, right? I was at a panel one time at a was it a MarsCon? I'm not sure. Actually, I think I was on the panel, and it was about swearing, right? And the point is of the panel was like so much of our swearing, like all of our swearing is so informed by our cultural mores, right? So if you don't have Christianity saying, oh my God, might or might not make sense, right? There are if sex is not a taboo, thing in your culture, then the F word isn't that big of a deal. You know what I mean? So I really wanted to think about, okay, well, what would make sense? And religious-based swears always make sense to people, right? Because there's like just a little edge of blasphemy that, it works. And
Well, I
I'd
mean, if
started.
you look at it in it's swearing and cursing. And both of these things, I swear by God, I curse you in this God's name. They make perfect sense. So yeah,
Right.
absolutely.
Yeah. And I knew just from, reading and literature and stuff that, in the past, certain terms like God's wounds, right? Was considered a swear or a curse or something. And so I kind of wanted to play with that idea a little bit because it had a lot of that sort of medieval feel that I said I wanted to cultivate. So I had Romic. I was like, okay, well, he's a warrior. He's got this gladiator background. I didn't talk about this, but once he earned his freedom, he went and joined a mercenary company as a private soldier. So not only is he experienced in like arena, exhibition style combat, he's experienced in like actual military engagement style combat as well. And so who's this guy going to venerate, right? Well, fighting people, soldiers from time immemorial have prayed to fortune because sometimes that's the only thing that makes the difference between living and dying is how freaking lucky are you? Do you feel lucky, punk? Right? So I was like, okay, so fortune, and I came up with this idea of this red lady. And so I was like, okay, so if that makes sense, then and knowing what that sort of helped me build his character as a he's controlled because he's very disciplined because of his military training. But when he lets himself off the leash, as it were, he's an absolute beast because he had to be, right? Like there's no quarter from this guy because there couldn't be, you know? And so how does that shape a guy's personality? What does that make him like? And I knew I wanted him to be physically big, because it made sense with his backstory that that's why he was chosen for to be a gladiator, is because he was just a big kid, you know, big, well-muscled kid. And so I have known some of the gentlest men that I have ever known in my life are some of the biggest, most violently capable men I've ever known in my life. And so I knew that I wanted to have those two things sort of coexist in him. He's not really gentle, but he is thoughtful about it, if that makes sense, you know? And I,
Where he could put pressure. Yeah.
yeah, exactly. 'Cause he's intelligent. I can't have sexy men not be intelligent because I find intelligence very sexy. So all three of these dudes are real smart. And I did the same thing with Dane, right? Like I knew that as a forester, he would probably revere some sort of nature deity. So I created this green lady who is, you know, again, a nature deity, but nature's freaking savage. Nature is wild. Nature will tear you up and not, you know, with zero morality to it. And so that helped me to understand that, okay, this guy, like he is as disciplined as he needs to be, but he's way more of a hothead than Romic. Like his temper is flash fire. He forgives very quickly, but he's also like, you know, he's touchy. He's touchier. And then Vil, as my thief, I figured that he would probably honor a deity of like darkness and shadows because that's what keeps him safe, right? So he's very cold. He's very icy. He's again kind of sociopathic, right? He's the kind of guy that when he looks at you, if he lets you, like he can mask, but if he lets you see it, you look at him and you're like, oh shit, that dude's a killer. Like you just know. He doesn't have to say anything, you know? So.
Bullshooter So, what was the single coolest thing for you about writing this book?
Writing Blood on the Sand, writing the arena battles. Yeah, writing the arena battle was so much fun. And it just sort of like flowed because I wanted this, like the whole series is an action series, right? So I'd written several action scenes in Mage Light. By the time we get to the arena battle in Blood on the Sand, there's several action scenes already in that. But the thing that's different about the arena is that it's for an audience. And so it
Sure.
was yeah,
Gotta
it
be
was really
a
right. And there's a scene where they're coming up from underneath the arena, you know, on a like an elevator lift type platform thingy, where Romic, who, you know, he's the veteran here, he's like, make sure you put on a good show. They want, you know, if we want the crowd on our side, right? But they'll turn on us quick, so make sure you put on a good show. And so all four of them are thinking this as they go up, you know, like, okay, let's put on a good show. And it was really fun for me to write about how they're keeping themselves and each other alive. You know, keeping another character that I introduce in this story alive, that's the reason that they're there, is because they're sort of championing this character and still trying to make it a good show. You know, I think at one point I have, you know, after Vil takes out someone who's you know, attacking Aelys, you hear the announcer speaking over the magically enhanced PA system that you know, oh, the Aegon takes out his, you know, the threat for his to his Bellatrix, and they hear this, and Aelys is like, give him a show, and so she lays a fat kiss right on him, you know, and the crowd goes wild, right? So like, it was really, really fun to write that kind of stuff, you know.
three ring circus as opposed to,
Yeah,
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 very cool.
yeah.
Well, I want to thank you again for coming on the show today. This has been awesome.
Thank
Want
you.
to ask you also where we can find you in the coming weeks. Keep in mind that this will be coming out the week before release.
Okay.
Where can we find you? And I know for myself because I got to read it and is we're going to have a short story that we'll have
Yes.
on the Bane website called Grief, that is the early days of the formation of the Empire and that kind of thing. It was really quite cool for me to be able to read that. So
Thanks.
I've read some stuff that's before everybody else's stuff. So I do have some slight
So,
advantages, and it whetted my appetite for reading the series. So.
yeah, fans of Mage Light will recognize some names in the story of Grief. So it's a little Easter eggy. You're welcome. I love you guys. So,
So we have a short story. Where else can we find you, and what else can we see you in?
you can find me online at my website, www.caseyezell.net, or .com. Either one works. They both go to the same place. All of my books are listed there. My socials are also listed there. I'm on X and Facebook and Instagram and TikTok. I also I don't know. So sorry. I also have an alternate history series with Bane that we, as of the time of recording this, we should be relatively close to turning in book three of the Romanov series. So hopefully that'll be coming out either late this year or early next year. Don't know
Also,
yet.
some of the coolest covers of
Yeah.
recent time.
Same artist, believe it or not.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, same artist. Yeah, beautiful, beautiful covers. I can't wait to see what we're gonna do for book three. So there's that as well. You can find me in person. Right now I am planning on attending LibertyCon and DragonCon. Subject to change due to life, perhaps, but as of right now, those are the plan. In addition, I think I told you this. I just released a course for creative people who are struggling with creative blocks and resistance to kind of help learn some mindset tools and resilience tools to overcome that kind of stuff. So anybody who is interested in information on that, you can hit me up on email, or I'll see if we can drop a link in the description. So yeah, that's where you can find me.
Very cool. Well, once again, thank you very much for being on the Bane Free Radio Hour today.
Thank you for having me.
We're super excited to see blood on the sand in people's sweaty palms as they. Okay.
Okay. Or, your clean, dry palms after you've washed your
Perfect.
hands.
Okay.
Whatever.
Perfect. Yes. Yeah.
Whatever you choose. It's up to
But
you.
this has been the Bane Free Radio Hour with Griffin Barber, and in to speaking with again one of his favorite people, Casey Yazelle.
And now, as promised, one jump ahead. John Moore is a nanotech-enhanced soldier of fortune. Lobo is an AI, a living weapons and intelligence platform of enormous destructive potential. Two very dangerous wolves in a galaxy of deadly corporate and paramilitary predators. But Moore has grown weary of the killing, and just once he'd like to finish a job without leaving a trail of blood behind him. Not going to happen. Not on a pristine planet called Makin, where two gigantic corporations vie for control of the local jump gate and access to the riches of an undeveloped world. Dealing with a kidnapping and extortion scheme is only the beginning for Moore and Lobo as they work to stay one jump ahead.
I stood near Chung's head, leaned against the wall, and watched the display. As the stimulant brought him around, his pulse rose and his respiratory rate climbed a tiny bit. But he didn't open his eyes. He quickly controlled the rhythm of his breath, kept it even, and neither moved nor opened his eyes. I smiled a bit in admiration. He was playing it like a pro, taking time to collect himself, gathering what data he could before he decided to let on that he was awake. If we were amateurs who'd kidnapped him for a ransom, the tactic might have brought him some potentially useful time and information. Jose, I said, using his first name both to annoy him and to show him we weren't going to abide by the usual corporate rules. We both know you're awake, so we might as well talk. He continued faking sleep. I wasn't in the mood to waste time, so I added some positive motivation for him. The sooner I get the information I want and we reach an understanding, the sooner you go home. He opened his eyes and tried to move his head. After he realized he couldn't, I stepped closer so he could see my face. "Who are you?" he said. "And what do you want?" I opened my mouth to remind him again not to waste time, but stopped when the wall display caught my eye. Nothing had changed. He didn't know my face. That meant he'd placed the bounty on my name alone, probably using information the gardeners on Mackin had somehow gotten out of Barnes. I should have erred on the side of caution and not let him see me. I'd made a mistake. But I reminded myself that it changed nothing. My predicament remained the same. I needed him to remove the bounty. "I'm the man," I said, "you placed a bounty on. And I'm also the man who knows about your illegal arms deals with Osterlad. You're going to remove the bounty and tell the FC about the arms deal. You'll probably lose your job, and Zycheck will certainly pay heavy fines, but you'll walk away unharmed." I paused a second. "Provided you don't make me hurt you." "What are you talking about?" he said. This time his vitals jumped, but consistently across the board, a pattern of agitation, not of attempted deceit. Maybe bounties were more common among the executive set than I'd realized, and he genuinely didn't remember all of the ones he'd set. That seemed unlikely, but possible. So I decided to fill in the blanks for him. "I called you once before," I said, "but you wouldn't talk to me then, so I had to arrange this conversation. I'm the guy who ruined your bid on Mackin by returning Slake's daughter, Jasmine, to him. Remember me now?" The calming drug Lobo had chosen must not have been very strong, because this time Chung's vitals raced up the display. Every indicator elevated beyond the yellow caution lines the med bed had computed for him. His face turned red, and for a moment he shook with the effort of trying to move. "You're the one who gave him Jasmine again?" he screamed. "I'll kill you!" "All I did," I said, "was return her to her father." "You're either a fan of sick games," he said, his body relaxing as he realized there was no point in struggling against the restraints, "or truly stupid." I was getting annoyed at his attempts to distract me, but I did my best to keep the feeling out of my voice as I leaned over him and said, "You're wasting time again. Let's get back to the bounty and the arms deal." He stared directly at me as he said, "Do you really not know what you did?" He looked at me intently for a few more seconds, then closed his eyes. "Jasmine is my daughter. I had no idea she'd ever escaped from Slake until you called." This was a strange tactic, and I had no more patience for games. "Last warning," I said. "Stop playing games." "Check my wallet," he said. "I had it when you kidnapped me." When I didn't move, he said, "Check it. What can that cost you?" The sincere look on his face caused a pit to open in my stomach, and all my elation at the successful mission tumbled into it. I pushed back all feeling, opened the medic room drawer, and pulled out the wallet. I put it in his right hand, temporarily removed the restraint on that hand, and stepped away from his reach. "Open it," I said. He thumbed it, tapped a security code, and held it out to me. I took it with my right hand, while with my left I forced his arm back down and snapped on the restraint. No point in taking chances. I opened the wallet, found two micro-thin photo displays, and pulled out the first. It unfolded as I flicked it. The images of Jasmine blazed into life. Jasmine, posing on the front steps of Chung's estate. Jasmine, laughing and holding a woman I didn't recognize. Jasmine, much younger and in Chung's arms. Jasmine, with her eyes shut as she kissed Chung on the cheek. Jasmine. 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 I was breathing hard, the air pounding roughly in and out of me, loud enough that Chung must have heard it. "Slake's people kidnapped her," he said. "He used her to force me to withdraw our bid for the Mackin development project and for the new aperture there." None of Chung's vitals showed the slightest sign of a lie. He was telling the truth. I'd returned an innocent girl to the man who'd arranged her kidnapping. An innocent girl. And I'd failed her.
This has been the Bain Free Radio Hour. Thanks for joining us at the heart of science fiction. Join us next week for part one of Sean Haslett's interview of Mike Cooperie about his latest novel, Twin Star. Score by Ruth Judkowitz.